is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not those of owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls. We have with us this evening Alexandra Robbins, and she's written a fascinating book, Secrets of the Tomb, Skull and Bones, the Ivy League, and the Hidden Paths to Power. Thank you so very much for being with us this evening.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, let's talk. This is a fascinating, fascinating book. And so it starts out, of course, talking about Skull and Bones, or at least the legend of Skull and Bones, that, of course, this is a secret society that came from the Illuminati, that it was named 322 because, of course, it was the second chapter, and it was established in 1832. It certainly is well over 70 years of age now. It's been around for a long, long time. And, of course, there's a tremendous amount that isn't known about it. And, of course, it's wrapped in mystique, and everything is, well, hidden. There are stories about having the skull of Geronimo there and the skull of Martin Van Buren and having Hitler's silverware there and having strong ties to Nazism. And, of course, Alexandra starts out the whole story making all of the allegations that have been made about the Skull and Bones, its origin from the Illuminati, and then, of course, says that is the legend. Now, here's the truth. So how did it happen that you became so interested in Skull and Bones?
Well, I did go to Yale, and at Yale, you just can't avoid hearing about Skull and Bones. Skull and Bones headquarters is sort of a crypt-like building. It's three stories high. It's supposed to have no windows, but it actually does have two small foots in the front, and you can't see in, but the bonesmen can see out. And the tomb is planted in the middle of the Yale campus, so you can't avoid walking past it on the way to classes, parties, whatever. And so there's this intense curiosity on campus throughout your years there, where you wonder what really does go on in there. After graduation, with George W. Bush campaigning and then becoming president, and then there was a movie out called The Skulls, my curiosity intensified, and I was curious how much and how often the president was using his secret society, so that got me into the subject.
Well, has through the years, George W. Bush used his contacts with fellow bonesmen to advance his business deals, and certainly as he surrounded himself with people from a parallel group, the Council on Foreign Relations, does he have a lot of people from these organizations within the structure of his government?
You know, this is actually one of the most surprising things I found when I researched this book. George W. Bush is so vocal about his dislike of Yale, his distaste for the Northeastern establishment scene, and his distance from those kinds of connections. So I just figured that he was telling the truth. However, I found that he is very involved with Skull and Bones throughout his life when he needed to turn to people for help. Beginning even with his first job right out of college, he turned to members of Skull and Bones. He got money from them. He got connections from them. He got job help from them. Even his baseball deal, which people generally hold up as something that he must have gotten on his own, there's a bonesman involved with that too. And now that he's president, he has put many members of Skull and Bones into positions of power in the Justice Department, in the Office of Homeland Security, even on Fannie Mae. And that was one of the most surprising things, because for someone who insists he's such a purebred Texan, so far from these Northeastern elite connections, you really don't expect that he'd have done the opposite of what he says he did. In fact, he did turn to Skull and Bones often.
And, of course, many people from Skull and Bones are members of the Council on Foreign Relations of his original committee that was pushing his nomination. I think.
Yeah, in fact, Winston Lord was a prominent bondsman who was also the president of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Well, I think 10 of the 11 people in that original committee came from the Council on Foreign Relations, and most of his key people now, at least Condoleezza Rice and Cheney and Rumsfeld, they all are CFR members, and they've been around part of this, which is a sort of part of the Eastern establishment, as it were, that really dominates both political parties. So let's get on into this part about Hitler. And the German connection. And, of course, the story, the myth that you talk about was the relationship between the formation of Skull and Bones and this German secret society. Is this accurate? Is this whole society really originate with this German society that used a skull and crossbones as its motto or emblem?
That was a rumor that I had fully expected to debunk during my investigation, and I was completely wrong. Yes, it does seem to be a chapter of a German organization. The founder of Skull and Bones, William Russell, studied abroad in Germany, came back to Yale, found that his prior secret society, Phi Beta Kappa, the Honor Society, which had been secret up until that point, had been stripped of its secrecy in the midst of the anti-Masonic fever. Russell was angry that he no longer had a secret society. He was inspired by the secret societies he found in Germany, and it does look like, from the evidence, that Skull and Bones is a chapter of a German organization. And there are also certainly German artifacts within the tomb. One of Skull and Bones' songs, they call their songs Sacred Anthems, is sung to the tune of the German national anthem.
The Duschen der Borealis?
Yes. And certainly there is evidence that members of Skull and Bones, individual members, including Prescott Bush, George W.'s grandfather, were on the boards of banks that stowed money for Hitler.
And, of course, you at one point showed, $3 million or something. I didn't quite understand where that money was. That given to Hitler, or was this just Hitler's money in American banks?
I believe it was Hitler's money in American banks.
Okay. And so there is at least some ties to Germany. Don't they have a lot of pictures of German things there? And what about swastikas, things like that?
They do have German artwork in the tomb. I think there are some engravings. I know there are many engravings in German. I think some of them actually have plaques saying for the American chapter. In terms of swastikas, I don't think there's any current connection between Skull and Bones and Nazis. Certainly, there were many anti-Semitic members of the organization, but if there are any items with swastikas on them that are now in the tomb, that would be because they are sort of souvenirs from World War II.
All right. Well, now, of course, have you been in the tomb? Have you ever had an opportunity to go inside and see what's there?
No, I did not.
All right.
Would have been too dangerous.
All right. Well, of course, there was a gentleman, Mr. I think was his name was Rosenbaum, was that it? Who had actually somehow or other got video cameras into one of the ceremonies. What was that story all about?
Well, he said that he videotaped a ceremony when he was overlooking the Bones courtyard from another campus building. But from what my sources told me, from what I know about secret societies and from what I genuinely believe, I don't believe he saw what he thought he saw. I think he might have seen a skit. He might have seen some sort of party activity, but I don't believe that that was a true Skull and Bones initiation. In fact, I came across a script for the Skull and Bones initiation. It's how Skull and Bones has conducted its initiation for years and years and years, and I have a whole chapter that describes what the initiation is really like.
Well, maybe we could get into that in a few minutes. Were any of the Skull and Bones members that you interview now, how many members would actually freely talk about this?
More than 100, many of them not so freely, but it took some persuading, but I kept most of them anonymous, and they were willing to speak with me.
All right. And of course, did any of them give you those copies of the black books with all the members in, you know, because they make these black books, you know, that tell about who everybody has been going back to 1833? Were you ever able to get hold of those black books?
I think I'm not going to say if the members gave me anything, only because I have received threats from Skull and Bones. They want to know who spoke to me for this book, and I do want to protect my sources.
All right, fine. So Well, I was able to get a copy of those black books. So
excellent.
We actually offer those. We don't offer the black books, but I had to get them back to where I came from. But we certainly offer the membership list of Skull and Bones going back to the 1830s. And, of course, what's really so amazing is the bloodline concept, that there will be bloodlines in this. And, of course, the Bushes. It's not just simply the president and his father, but
that's right.
How many Bushes have there been in Skull and Bones?
There have been 9 Bushes in Skull and Bones, which is a staggering number, considering that one of the founders of Skull and Bones was a Taft. The Tafts have been a prominent family in Skull and Bones, and they only have 8 members. The Bush family will have its 10th member tapped in April with Barbara Bush, who is a junior at Yale right now.
All right, and Chris, they've only recently opened up, what was it, about 1991, 92, to women?
Yeah, after a long, fierce battle in 1991, Skull and Bones finally voted in a very narrow vote to let women in. Afterwards, many of the older members dissociated from the society, and during the fight, there was a lawsuit against the members of the society who wanted to induct women that claimed that if women were admitted, there would be date rape in the medium-term future.
All right,
my knowledge, that hasn't happened.
All right, fine. But, of course, there were certainly a lot of things, apparently, that were of very intimate detail that you might think that some of the members might be loath to discuss in the presence of women.
Yes, and I think that they didn't know Yale women as I know Yale women, being one myself. One of the most crucial activities in Skull and Bones is called the sexual history. It's known within the society as connubial bliss, or CB. And up until the time women were admitted, Skull and Bones also referred to all women as connubial bliss. During that activity, which begins in September, it's pretty much the first major activity that the new members have during their senior year at Yale. A knight, which is what they call the 15 Yale seniors, a knight will have to stand in front of a painting of a woman, which is also called connubial bliss, in a dimly lit, cozy room in front of the 14 other knights, and there that knight is supposed to recount his or her entire sexual history. It's an activity that's supposed to take the entire evening. However, knowing Yale men, they probably take as long as their creativity and embellishment will allow them to. I don't believe that this has gotten any less graphic now that women have been involved, just knowing the Yale women over there.
Well, now, what about the coffin bit? We've all heard that when men are inducted into the Skull and Bones, they lay in a coffin. Was that part of what you were told?
No. There may be one or two coffins in Skull and Bones. They're not used. At least they're not used anymore in the way that people thought they were. I've heard of a coffin used at a Skull and Bones wedding ceremony. At members' weddings, there's sort of a special ceremony where the bride and the groom are taken aside into a special room, and the non-bone spouse is sort of initiated into the society. I've heard there's a coffin involved with that. I know the most scandalous rumor about Skull and Bones, or one of them, at least the most titillating, is that new members, the initiates, must lie naked in a coffin and masturbate while recounting their sexual histories. That doesn't happen now. I doubt if it ever happens, although certainly in the 1800s, early 1900s, when you got so many young college men in a windowless tomb at one time, you never know what they might have been doing.
All right, fine. Of course, now, the descriptions you have of the initiation, was all of the various people you talked to tell essentially the same story as to what it involved? Because some of these must have been much older than the more recent inductees. Has it always been exactly the same?
In fact, everything about Skull and Bones, except for the admission of women, has always been exactly the same, and they pride themselves on that. Skull and Bones is like a time warp. They tend to do things only because they've always been done a certain way. They're very insistent on tradition. They like to keep that lineage and that sense of continuity going, and it helps bond new members to the society because the new young members know that everything they're doing is something that Skull and Bonesmen have been doing since 1832. So they can look back and say, oh, well, this is a tradition that George Bush took part in. Henry Stimson, Averill Harriman, Henry Luce, William Howard Taft, all of these men did exactly what I am doing now.
And Prescott Bush and George Herbert Walker Bush and George
Bushes.
Bush. Right. Now, one of the things you mentioned was the grandfather clock. And at least the gentleman that I don't know him personally. He passed away, but his daughter told me that, her father had gotten this grandfather clock from Skull and Bones. Is that a tradition that when you were a Skull and Bonesman, you always got this grandfather's clock?
That is the Skull and Bones wedding gift, or at least it was until the late 1960s. I heard from someone in the late 1960s that they didn't have as much funds as they used to have, so it turned into sort of a grandmother clock, and the clocks are much smaller than they used to be. But it was tradition that at the wedding ceremony for Skull and Bones, the new groom and bride would receive a grandfather clock. It's very symbolic. The whole concept of time is very symbolic in Skull and Bones. For example, within the tomb, the clocks are always set 5 minutes faster than the rest of the world, and I was told that's because members want to feel as if time stands still in Skull and Bones, that they're apart and insulated from the rest of the world.
Well, now, Kirsch, what about the island that they have where inductees can go and relax and have a very, very pleasant time? It's called Deer Island?
Yes, that's right. Skull and Bones has owned Deer Island since the beginning of the 20th century. It was given to them as a gift by one of the members. It's about 350 miles from New York City on the St. Lawrence River, and it's a retreat for the members. They have artifacts there, sort of like Skull and Bones museums. They have lodging, and the new members go in about early to mid-May for about a week to bond with each other. They're sort of sent alone, where only the 15 of them will be there on the island, except for perhaps the servants, and they're supposed to learn to get to know each other then, because they'll be spending a very intense year ahead.
Now, it sounds like it's really rather elitist. There are always servants there. It seems there's servants always in the tomb, aren't there? At least serving their meals and giving them a full lobster anytime that they're there and things of that sort.
They probably don't call them servants anymore. They're certainly paid, and I believe they're usually dining hall workers now. But I know that at least one member told me that he tried to quit the society because he was upset. What happened was he had a tutoring program for young African-American kids in New Haven, and he wanted to know if he could use the extra rooms in the tomb to help tutor the kids. The society, of course, said no, and when he got to the tomb for dinner one Thursday night directly from tutoring these kids, he sat down and he said to me that, an African-American servant came over and put a whole lobster in front of him just for showing up, and he couldn't take it anymore because he didn't think that was just. And he tried to quit the society, but Skull and Bones wouldn't let him. They said, once you're in, you can't get out.
All right. So they seem to really have a tremendous hold on the people. At least many of them will not talk about it. They won't even tell their families what really goes on in the tomb. And certainly you mentioned that April Harriman would not mention this, that the tradition is if you were in a room and somebody mentioned Skull and Bones, you're to get up and walk out. Is that right?
It used to be that way up until the mid to late 20th century. I know that many reporters on the 1988 campaign trail of George Bush sort of wondered giddily whether at a press conference if they suddenly yelled Skull and Bones or 322 if George Bush would suddenly hop up and dash out of the room. He wouldn't have, but that did used to be the tradition.
But of course he wasn't really being entirely forthright. He was asked about his membership. And he said, oh, is that organization still around? I didn't even think it was still in existence. Some words of that sort. And
well,
that really isn't honest at all,
yes.
Is it? I mean, was that really, don't you think he's really not telling the truth?
George W. Bush said that, and no, he doesn't tell the truth about Skull and Bones. He feigns playfulness about it. He feigns detachment from it. But he knows it exists. In fact, one of the first social gatherings he had at the White House after his inauguration was, in fact, a Skull and Bones reunion.
Well, now, do you have any idea what sort of oaths that they take? Because there have to be some sort of an oath that would bind these people together and bond them to the secrecy, which, of course, in most instances, they abide by.
I believe there's a secrecy oath that takes place during initiation.
Now, do you know what that might be?
I don't know the exact words. I wasn't able to find that. However, I'm getting new information every day now from members of secret societies and from people who managed to break into the tomb. So that might be something I come up with shortly.
Well, now, one of the most interesting, to me, parts of the book was your description of the marriage ceremony. And this had been witnessed by somebody who, of course, had no allegiance to the society. In fact, I would be, worried, you know, that these people might not always be telling the truth, because, as you mentioned in your book, they create a lot of myths, they create a lot of stories, and they openly admit that these stories aren't true. But the story that you told, and I thought it was the most fascinating one, at least it appealed to me most, was about a woman that you'd interviewed who had actually witnessed a marriage ceremony. And this was a very strange ceremony, because here were these members of Skull and Bones wearing black robes with hoods and chanting these pagan rituals in a marriage ceremony. What was this all about?
Yeah, that surprised me, because that's not something that they usually take part in the tomb. And that involved a coffin, and it involved chanting and strange rituals and strange oaths. And this poor woman was hiding up in a loft watching the ceremony, and after a while, she couldn't take it anymore, and she stood up and she said, you guys are full of it. And the bonesmen were shocked that she was there, and she said five or six of them came running up the stairs, and they threatened her.
Yeah, and they would threaten her because, of course, they didn't want anybody to know. In fact, didn't one of them say, never tell anybody what you saw?
Right. They say that a lot.
And so basically, why they didn't want people to know about this pagan side of the Skull and Bones.
Right.
And so there really is something there. Did any of the bonesmen ever tell you about that? Because obviously, if these things had gone on, the bonesmen would know about it. But did anybody ever tell you about this, the pagan rites that at least are part of the Skull and Bones activities?
Well, I was able to come across a journal of a Skull and Bones man, and I poured through it, and I found a few mentions of Skull and Bones, and one of them was of the wedding ceremony. He didn't go into too much detail, but he suggested that it's something that's very intense. It's something that some brides do well at, some brides do not do well at, and it certainly forges a new bond within the organization, or at least within those 15 members.
Well, do you think that there is a spiritual element to this? They keep talking about the goddess Eulogia. There certainly is nothing here of a Christian nature at all, is there, in this in the proceedings?
No, it's not Christian. It's something different, something very strange.
Yeah, something develop that. I think that's really so important. There's something very strange, almost mystical about Eulogia,
yes,
and all of this.
Certainly. Skull and Bones legend has it, and this is sort of the lore that's told within the society, that in 322 B.C., Demosthenes, the Greek orator, died. And when he died, the goddess Eulogia, who they call the goddess of eloquence, ascended to the heavens, and she didn't come back down again until 1832, when she happened to take up residence in Skull and Bones. Within the Skull and Bones tomb, there's sort of a little shrine to Eulogia, and everything is done in deference to Eulogia. For instance, throughout the year, they're supposed to apparently steal artifacts from the world, bring them back to the tomb, and they call those gifts to the goddess. It's almost sacrificial.
Well, now, what about the skull of Geronimo?
Well, there is a skull within the tomb that the members of Skull and Bones still call Geronimo, although some of them insist it's not really. However, I did come across a copy of a document that looks to be an authentic Skull and Bones document. You can tell by the way they encode it and the language that they use, and I believe it is real. And that document describes Prescott Bush, George W.'s grandfather, and several other members of Skull and Bones. In 1917, they were stationed at Fort Sill. They apparently robbed Geronimo's grave. There's a whole description about how they cleaned the skull with carbolic acid and took some personal items, scurried it back to the tomb, and it's been there ever since. Native Americans are up in arms about this. They tried many times to get Geronimo's skull back. They appealed to George Bush. They appealed to Senator McCain. They were not able to get it back. And, in fact, they had a confrontation with Skull and Bones about it that I detail in the book.
Now, I think that's really very interesting that these people can get away with grave robbing and stealing things that really have tremendous significance to other people. And yet, nothing is ever done to them.
Yes, and as I found, and there's an anecdote about this in Secrets of the Tomb, even the New Haven Police Department is scared of Skull and Bones.
So why would the police be scared of Skull and Bones? Why, you would think that they would have to obey the same laws that the rest of us do.
Well, the police officers that I spoke with genuinely believe some of the rumors that I found were false. For example, one day I was standing outside of the tomb waiting to see if George Bush would walk inside since he was in for the weekend. And I asked the policeman if he had been there yet. And the policeman said, oh, he wouldn't go in the door. He'd come in through one of the tunnels. And I said, there aren't any tunnels. I have the floor plans to the tomb, and there are only two entrances, and they're here and here. And he said, no, there are tunnels running all over the city. Bush could get into the tomb from anywhere on campus. And I said, you've been down there? How do you know that? And he said, well, I saw the movie, and he was serious.
Well, anyway, of course, now what about some of the other skulls? They have an awful lot of skulls around there, don't they? In other words, there's almost this morbid fascination with death.
There's several dozen skulls in the tomb. There are human skulls, animal skulls. They have skeletons. They have a mummy. There's artwork all over the tomb about death, about executions, about hell. And I think that they told me that they have the death motif within the tomb because they want to be reminded of how short their existence is. And somebody else in the tomb told me that there's sort of a pressure within there. All these reminders of how short life is really pushed them to realize that they must succeed. They must attain a level of prominence fitting of the society before they die, or else they haven't achieved the purpose of Skull and Bones.
I see. And of course, the purpose then of Skull and Bones is what? That these people will make a mark in the world? That these people will be a brotherhood that will influence what's going on in our society?
Yes, that's it. It's power. The purpose of Skull and Bones is to better its members in order to befit certain levels of success in the world. And once Bonesmen reach levels of success, they are expected to pull other Bonesmen to that high level of prestige and prominence with them. Yeah. And they do it. And it's just staggering that even now, even in 2002, in 21st century America, Skull and Bones is still doing this as well as ever has.
And, of course, we find their men in positions of power whenever we seem to go to war. And Stimson,
yes.
Working very hard during the Second World War. And, of course, his diary is there at Yale University in the Sterling Library. I remember going through it, and where he writes about how the only question was how we were going to get into the Second World War and get the Japanese to fire the first shot. In other words, he was intent upon getting into the war. And then, of course, McGeorge Bundy manipulating us into Vietnam with the Gulf of Tonkin incident, which, of course, at least according to people who were there, never occurred. But 58,000 American boys later, why we finally pull out. But McGeorge Bundy, certainly a member of Bones, as was his brother, and in fact, he was very, very close to Henry Stimson, and so
and his father,
right. And so we find these people always in position as America moves into war after war after war.
Yes, that's absolutely right. In fact, when Henry Stimson was Secretary of War, he believed very strongly that unless a man went to Andover, Yale, and Skull and Bones, he didn't have much merit. So he surrounded himself and his department with members of Skull and Bones, and he put the Bonesmen in charge of the deployment of the atomic bomb.
And, of course, they were there in key positions, many of them in key positions in the War Department during the war.
Yes.
And, of course, that war went on and on and on.
And again, during the Bay of Pigs invasion.
Right. In fact, we could talk for hours on the Bay of Pigs. Anyway, I believe that was an ambush. It was an ambush for the men we sent ashore. No way they could possibly get out of the trap they'd been put in. And they paid dearly for trusting the men who had promised them that they wanted them to overthrow Fidel Castro. And to this very day, they know they were betrayed. And not simply because we withdrew the air power, but the location of the invasion was one where there was no way they could possibly succeed. Well, anyway, as far as the Skull and Bones, you have certainly been actually threatened putting this information together?
Yeah, I was threatened after an article I wrote for the Atlantic Monthly on this topic appeared a couple of years ago. I got a call at my office from someone whom I knew to be a member of Skull and Bones, and at first he was very nice. He said my article was the most thorough and tremendously accurate that the Society had ever seen about Skull and Bones, and he said, oh, we just want to know whom you spoke to, and he tried to get me to name the members of Skull and Bones whom I had spoken with, and of course I wasn't going to do that, and after he realized there was no way I was going to reveal my sources, he started to get angry. He spent a long time berating me, telling me that my article wasn't ethical, wasn't honorable, and on and on. And he ended the conversation by telling me that Skull and Bones has members at many of the newspapers, magazines, and journal and political institutions across America, and basically insinuated that my career as an investigative journalist was over, that they would blacklist me.
Now, we're going to take a three-minute break. If you'd like a cup of coffee or a drink of water, and then we'll be right back here with Alexandra Robbins. And welcome. Do you mind taking calls?
Oh, absolutely. They can call me, and they can also email me at secretsofthetomb.com.
All right, we'll be right back.